So what I figured I would talk about today, and I wish there were more people here, but fortunately we will be recording it and people can listen, is my the conference that I went to last week. So I realized that many of you are going to need some background, because this was the Soto Zen Buddhist Association conference, and I realized some of you may need background on Soto Zen and on what it means to be a priest and on what this whole organization is about. So I'll try to briefly go through that. There's Zen is the Japanese word for chan, which is, means meditation. So we're the meditation school of Buddhism, which arose in China in the 9th century, or earlier than that. And then in China, several different, many different schools of Zen evolved. And one of them was the Chaodong school, which then in Japanese, that's called Soto. And then the school that does koans, the Linji school, which then that's Rinzai in Japanese. So those are kind of the two primary Zen schools that have ended up in the West. So, and that Chaodong or Soto went to Japan in the 13th century with Dogen, who's, you know, we often read his writings. So then, Soto Zen made, this particular sect of Zen made it to the West in 1922 was, I mean it was there before that, but 1922 was the first Soto Zen mission established in the West. And I think it was in LA, and which means, interestingly, in 2022 we'll have the 100th anniversary of Soto Zen in the West, and hopefully it will be celebrated by both Japanese people and American converts. So then in, you know, say like the 50s and the 60s was this boom of either, if in the case of Soto, Japanese teachers coming to, and then starting centers or temples, lineages that really become large and significant, and or, as in the case of our lineage, somebody, a Westerner, who went to Japan and completed the study and then came and established something in the West. So our lineage ancestor is Roshi Kiyokennet, who was an English woman who went, it's an incredible story, which she wrote a book about the, I mean, Zen training's hard anyway. And to be a Western woman in an all-male Japanese monastery in the 50s is kind of mind-blowing. But she went through all of that, and then she started the monastery in California. Right. And then Kyoga to Gyokuko, studied there, and then that's how we all lived. Shasta Abbey. And so at that, around that same time, Shinru Suzuki's setting up, you know, San Francisco Zen Center and that lineage in San Francisco, Maizumi's in LA, Katagiri's in the Twin Cities, and so there's several different kind of founders of that time. Not all Soto Zen in the West is from these people, but a lot of it is. So over time, because as Westerners, each of these lineages just, they set things up, they use their own translations of things, they use their own terms, they threw out what they wanted to throw out and kept what they wanted. And, you know, I mean, Western, individualistic, you know, herd of cats kind of thing. So there's been no, within lineages, sometimes there's some degree of organization, but really when, in our tradition, when somebody receives Dharma transmission, which I did and which Shintai did, and we're empowered as a Zen teacher, really, especially in the West, we're free to go. We're free to do what we want. I mean, within ethical boundaries and stuff. So even within lineages, there's not necessarily, like, once you're Dharma transmitted, I can't really tell you, you know, what to chant or exactly what to teach or anything. So it was kind of chaotic and ran into ethical problems, as I think many of you know, because people were so isolated and kind of maverick. And I mean, so just to backtrack a little bit, in Japan, the Soto school, so if you ever travel there, it'd be very interesting. The Soto school in Japan, I would say, is as organized as the Catholic Church. I mean, it is extremely organized. It has a bureaucracy, it has an associated university, there's different standards and requirements, there's paperwork, there's, you know, if you're ordained and then you have to do this ceremony and do that, and there's different levels of priesthood, not just like, you know, Dharma transmission and now you're good. You know, I mean, there's all these different levels of education and then corresponding things you're empowered to do. And I mean, there's criticism of that system, and Roshi Kennett, when she left Japan, she had such negative experiences, she cut all ties with Japan. And subsequently, all of her ordained students like have nothing to do, I mean, or I should say they're not part of the Japanese system. So we're not registered with Japan, we haven't filled out the proper paperwork, nothing. So, let's see, where was I going? Oh, so one of the strengths of that, you know, really bureaucratic system is it does make everybody interdependent. If we're going to have a Shuso ceremony, we need a teacher from here and a teacher from there and a teacher from there. We need to, you know, and the Soto Shu would be coming in and checking up on us. And so it means that you're not alone, that there's peers, there's other people, there's, you're connected. So if things are starting to go off the rails, you know, there's people to turn to. There's a structure. So the Japanese Soto Shu, frankly, did not know what to do with us at all. I mean, there was a few lineages that kept, that tried to keep the connection and would send their students to Japan to jump through the proper hoops, but relatively few. And at first, of course, they thought we were just doing everything wrong. But after a while, I mean, they've been evolving in their own understanding of Soto Zen, because frankly, in Japan, like churches in many parts of the world, Soto Zen's kind of dying. It's kind of getting stale. Nobody, you know, sanghas are shrinking. They're getting all old. They're all just full of old ladies. And, you know, so they're questioning their own approach to all of this as well. And then they look to the West and they see our vibrant Zen centers. They see our growing, we're running out of space, we're gonna need more room, and they're like, so over time, they have turned to us with more curiosity and respect, especially as their own generations change and there's younger priests involved. So one thing they did was in 1995, they suggested that we start an organization of our own. So like, we don't know what to do with you, but maybe you guys can figure it out, and then we'll talk to that. And so the concept of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association was born. Nothing really happened on it for about 6 years, but then they fired up a board, and then they started having biennial conferences. So 2004 was the first conference, and it was held at Great Vow Zen Monastery, out, you know, 90 minutes from here. Mm-hmm. And my teacher, Kyogen Carlson, was on the board, and Soto's teacher. So he was pivotal, and my teachers, and Hogen and Chosen Bays, were really pivotal in this whole thing from the very beginning. 2008 was my first conference. I was still an associate member, not a transmitted teacher. That was at San Francisco Zen Center, and then I was the first associate board member. So they decided, because they were starting to have associate members, ordained people, but they weren't teachers yet, they wanted one of those people on the board. So I got on the board, and I was on the board for 6 years, and then I was their administrative coordinator for 2 years before I decided to relinquish and do something else. So really, over the last 15 years or so, it's been a tough process. It's been frustrating because, you know, that's a very young organization and is trying to figure out what are we, what are we for, who belongs, should we have any standards, or is this just a collegial thing? What, I mean, and even how to make decisions or anything. And we're really only meeting every other year. And so it's like things go painfully slow. And the first time that we mentioned maybe we should have standards for membership. So we never, like, we don't touch Dharma transmission. That's between the teacher and the student. You know, we might have some suggestions, but that we can't deal with that. But membership in the organization, which theoretically could become something that, like, our bylaws say that our the next teacher of Bright Ways End needs to be somebody who would be recognized by this organization. So what does that mean? Because ordination, this opens up a whole different can of worms, which I'll have to go into another time, but ordination versus lay practice, ordained versus lay practice, monk versus lay, whatever. I mean, in Japan, in the Meiji era, the government decreed that monks could get married, didn't have to shave their heads, and could eat meat. And there's all kinds of political reasons they did this. A large part was to decrease the power of the clergy, which was getting very influential and very rich, and to actually kind of decrease that their influence by tying them to social obligations. Anyway, so it just confused the whole idea, really, of what a priest is. But at least the Sotoshu has a requirement that you, well, they have many requirements, but the big one is that you have to do a minimum of two 90-day training ongo. And in Japan, this is a very specific thing. It's a very intense thing. It's, you know, that whole time you're living in a monastery, you're following a schedule with everyone else, you learn this and you learn that, and you know, it's this intensive training. So we get to the West, and people start ordaining people, including Shunryu Suzuki, including Roshi Kennett. I mean, they just start ordaining people because they want to train, or later on because they have practiced for quite a while and they want this person to be able to function as something of a minister or a teacher. So, and in the history of Buddhism, it's been the monks and the priests that have any kind of authority. So in order to give their, what I would call their lay students, any kind of authority, they just ordain them. And we're not in the Sotoshu, so it doesn't require them to do ongo. So essentially they're ordaining people who to my mind and the way that my lineage looks at it, are not monks or priests. They're lay people with jobs and careers, and, you know, they're in the midst of a life like any of you. But because you have, you know, a love for the Dharma and you really want to practice deeply and you want to serve the Sangha, I ordain you. So that just started, so it's kind of like the cat's out of the bag. Now there are, yeah.
Would you, Soto Shu, would you?
Oh, the Soto Shu means school.
Okay.
So the Sotoshu is the Japanese official Japanese Soto organization.
Thank you. I needed that.
Okay. Thank you for jumping in there, because I just start throwing that out. So now, if you picture our conferences and we're talking about standards and we're talking about what we should do and who should be included, now we have people out in our circle. Who they think of themselves as priests, and they are ordaining people who I think of as lay people, and they are strongly believe in that. They are identified with that. They feel it's completely legitimate, and now we're having a conversation about how, in order to be part of this organization, you need to go do this residential training ongo, which is impossible for most lay people. If you've got a busy career and a job, you can't take 3 months off to go do that. So it's very divisive and personal, because it threatens people's, you know, legitimacy as an ordained person. Anyway, so we wrangled about this for 10 years, and only very recently, and this is what the Sotoshu was hoping we'd figure out, you know, like, who are you people? What does it even mean for you to be priests? Please tell us. And we couldn't agree. But eventually, but just in 2017, we actually, and I worked on this for about 8 years myself, in 2017, finally like kind of rammed through a version of these standards, which basically that pivotal requirement is now 1 3-month ongo, which can be broken into 3-week chunks. Even that was very, very controversial, but we managed to, with new kind of new leadership in the SCBA, they finally were just like, let's take it to a vote, bang, it's done. So in a way it's like, phew, let's just stop talking about that. And actually, the just on a side note, the Japanese, there's also an international office that, I can't remember if it's in LA or San Francisco, they're looking for ways to kind of get more people back into the fold, because they still have this very limited membership of people who kept this, you know, very official, very difficult, very expensive relationship with Japan. Like, I would have had to go to do this elaborate formal ceremony at the 2 head temples, and it costs a lot of money, and it costs money just to travel there, and not go through all of this hullabaloo so that I would be, and that would be the least of the hoops that I would have to jump through to be a recognized priest in Japan. Not to mention, my whole ordination is illegitimate. And yet, the Japanese priests are starting to respect. They see that, you know, priests like in our lineage, they do recognize that there's something important there and that we have something in common, and we want to learn more again from Japan. So there's some hope there, especially because some of the Japanese priests in this international office are young and speak English, and 2 of them, just before this conference, 2 of them joined the SCBA and were part of our kind of induction ceremony. So, I mean, the fact that they are coming toward us to figure out what we are and stuff like that. So, that will be, I think, a significant thing over the course of the next 5 to 10 years is kind of reconnecting with our Japanese roots and stuff, which I think will be really amazing. I'll get more into this in a little bit, but because we have only taken certain parts of the tradition from Japan, and I really will get into this. We like that meditation part, you know, we like the teachings, we like that whole idea of absolute and relative, you know, and it's all individual kind of self-power practice, and we like meditation retreats. We took these pieces, and then we left all that stuff that's just cultural, like the celebrations and the, you know, slightly more woo-woo stuff that really, you know, lights some people's fire, and the community-based stuff that's really been there all along, but we think that's not really Zen. So we've really looked at it through a particular lens, and there's all kinds of rich stuff in our tradition that we could avail ourselves of. So right now, so I feel like this was the first conference where as the Soto Zen priests and leadership, we were looking outward instead of inward. What can we do? How can we improve the way that we share the Dharma, and how can we serve our sanghas better, and etc. So that was very exciting. I mean, it was pretty boring to just talk about ourselves for 15 years. The board is just taken off, and they have 3 initiatives that they identified as priorities. One is staying in better contact between conferences, because, like I was saying earlier, peer relationships are the biggest way to prevent these ethical violations. Almost every one of those stories that you hear about Zen teachers that went off the rails, they're almost always isolated. They almost always did not belong to the SCBA. They did not belong to these other organizations. They did not show up. They just did their own little isolated thing. Not in all the case of all the Buddhist teachers, but it's common. Their second is the inclusion. This is really radical. The inclusion of lay teachers in the organization, and or maybe even beyond that, starting to make it more of a denominational thing and have sanghas as members. And this was Kyogen's dream, but when we first brought it up way back when, it was just way too early. People were even trying to figure out how it even means to be a priest. We don't want to talk about what it means to be a layperson. We just, so that whole topic was shelved. But I find it, I'm going to be, not that I have the time, but I'm going to be participating in this the committee that's going to try to further this whole question, because frankly, I just find it really unfortunate and unfair and ridiculous that I was at that conference last week and Shintai wasn't. Mm-hmm. If we are, you know, the Soto Zen leadership deciding where Soto Zen is going to go, and we have growing numbers of empowered lay teachers, and frankly, when I'm at that conference, I feel a fair amount of cognitive dissonance because I have a different idea about what it means to be a priest than many of these people do. And many of these people, by my estimation, I don't say anything, but are lay people. So I would feel less cognitive dissonance if we just made it all Zen teachers. Let's just open it up, and if they were there. And then we could get into interesting conversations about, oh, in your lineage, that means to be a priest. Oh, okay, we'd call it a lay person. All right. So I think that's very exciting. But what the third initiative is, and this is all new language to me, but it's diversity, equity, and inclusion. And just because I did not know what those terms meant, I will share with you what they mean. Maybe you already know, but so diversity is basically just the demographic mix of a group, a particular group, taking into account usually racial and ethnic groups, LGBTQ populations, people with disabilities, women, you know, various populations that have been excluded or oppressed in various ways. So that's just kind of that, you know, what's your makeup? And I have to say, at our conference, where there were 70 priests, some of them teachers and some of them associate members, there was one African-American person. And I don't even know, thinking back, I don't even know if anybody else would have identified themselves as a person of color. So we got some, we're not diverse. Equity, improving, and this I got from a place online, improving equity is to promote justice, impartiality, and fairness within the procedures, processes, and distribution of resources by institutions or systems. So tackling equity issues requires an understanding of the underlying or root causes of outcome disparities within our society. And then finally, inclusion refers to the degree to which diverse individuals are able to participate fully, not just in the group itself, but also in decision-making processes within the organization or group. So, for instance, while a truly inclusive group is necessarily diverse, a diverse group may not necessarily be inclusive. So, our good friend and Dharma brother Thomas Bruner was at the conference. And it was great because we had all these presentations, and his just brought it all together because he had these really practical suggestions for Zen centers, which really were thought-provoking. And he did this survey as well of Zen centers. I filled it out for us, you know, about how many people of color do we have, about how many people with disabilities, and are we handicapped accessible, and various things like that. Anyway, he said, you know, not surprisingly, Soto Zen sanghas are overwhelmingly white, and not so good on people with disabilities. Very good representation of that would be white, LGBTQ people, and women. But then again, we're just talking about diversity. We're just talking about kind of the makeup of the demographics. It doesn't necessarily reflect, you know, power dynamics and decision making. And he points out that Zen centers pretty typically have beautiful inclusivity statements. which we do on our website. So we say, this Sangha acknowledges that suffering is a human condition which can be made worse because of biases or prejudices for or against any race, ethnic origin, sexual orientation, sexual identity, political party, or other belief or position. This Sangha welcomes and affirms all who come here to seek the way and will work toward respectful acceptance of others across our many differences, harmonizing the one and the many. So Thomas says, that's great. You know, that's super. You know, good for you. So we just sit doing what we do and we say, you are all welcome here. Why aren't anybody coming? You are all welcome here. You know. So he's encouraging us to develop equity statements, which would really, you know, tie us a little more to, all right, that's all fine and good, but we need to acknowledge that our society at large, and then therefore probably also within our own structures, there are things that perpetuate these kinds of inequalities, and to say this is something that we want to change, that we're committed to changing this. So I just want to emphasize that the fact that we talked about DEI, I got the lingo now, at this conference is just radical and amazing. I mean, it's being influenced by the, you know, culture of the whole country as well, but convert lineages like ours, and our keynote speaker was Anne Gleig, who's a assistant professor of religion and cultural studies at the University of Central Florida. And she's writing a chapter for a book that's coming out called American Dharma. And she's writing the chapter 6, The Dukkha of Racism. And she was brilliant. I mean, she was a scholar, but she's also a practitioner. And she laid it all out there for us. She described how, you know, in every culture that Buddhism has traveled to, it's adapted and changed. I mean, you know, you have to change it for your audience and culture and whatever. And so we need to recognize we have done that. Because the myth is we have the pure Dharma. You know, we have the essence of Buddhism. The fundamental truths are there. And it's all pure and it's all kind of universally true, and kind of pat ourselves on the back that we have preserved the essence. And she's saying, you know, every culture has adapted and changed. And in particular, she pointed out how the things that we have drawn as primarily white convert Buddhists are those things which fit with and support and legitimize our existing structures of whiteness. So she was asking the question, and I'm also getting introduced to this whole concept of whiteness. Like, the Jim Crow era of white supremacy has been replaced by a subtler legitimation of structural dominance. The maintenance of white Anglo-American identity and culture as universal, normative, and dominant. The taken for grantedness of white power, the hidden nature of white identity, or what has been called colorblindness, emphasizes the systematic marginalization, erasure, and oppression of people of color, rather than individual racist actions or bias. So you know, this looking at whiteness, examining whiteness, isn't just about, well, I've got nothing, you know, I'm not racist, I haven't caught up in one of those white power rallies. It's like, well, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about cultural and systemic stuff. So her question, which I found very interesting, is how is whiteness maintained and reproduced through modern values of individualism and universalism, and how are such principles amplified by religious commitments? So she's not just blaming Buddhism here. She's saying these are themes that are in many of our Western religions, which just legitimize and support racism and other forms of oppression. So she says, how do Buddhist modernist this is their terminology, Buddhist modernism is our modern take, which actually the Japanese started it after World War II. They started it on their own, trying to remake Zen and Buddhism in a more of a Western image to make it more legitimate in the eyes of, you know, everything's trying in Westernization. So how do Buddhist modernist characteristics, particularly the focus on individual meditation practice, the distinction between essential and cultural Buddhism, and the presentation of Dharma as universal, intersect with whiteness? So the critiques by people who focus on this is that our Buddhism is too individualistic, too focused on meditation, too scientific and rational, and that the essential cultural distinction is ethnocentric and racist. Gosh. So I'll just leave it that we got more to study there. So she characterized Buddhist modernism in North America, common characteristics, so that's that strong emphasis on meditation practice, downplaying the cosmological and ritual elements, pragmatic and psychologically oriented, individualistic with participants showing little interest in community building. That's starting to change, but definitely originally. Overwhelmingly white, middle to upper class, highly educated, politically liberal demographic. There's an increase in female teachers, but little racial or class diversity. So, in terms of, you know, so we were getting this information, and thankfully then, you know, Thomas talked about stuff that we can do. And there will be more, you know, I'll be talking about this more, but I'm friends with Thomas, and he came over. We have a guest room where my parents are staying right now, but sometimes we have adult overnights, you know, we have friends and they just come and then we can, you know, have some wine and stay up late, and then they can just go to bed, and then we have coffee in the morning, you know, so it's kind of, so he came for one of those, and the whole time, we were talking a lot about this, because he was going to be coming out to the SCBA conference, and he was talking, you know, about wanting to, and he's working with Dharma Rain, they've hired him to work on, you know, what's the next steps they should take for diversity, equity, and inclusion, and I just told him, like, honestly, you know, I just think about, you know, we do what we do, we are who we are. We sit, we happen to be white, most of us, you know, we are who we are. And if people want to come, they can come, and that's great. And I'm not gonna, like, it feels almost kind of selfish to be like, well, I wish there was more diversity, as if it reflects well on me or us. Like, it can be kind of a self-centered thing. Like, we want to be more diverse so that we look good, you know? Mm-hmm. So I wasn't interested in that, but I was like, I don't know, what's the big deal? I mean, I was just trying to be honest about my initial response. So we had some very interesting discussions, and over the course of the evening, and then we went out to breakfast, and by the end of breakfast, I was like, because and this is what I told him to emphasize, and he really did at the conference, and just knocked it out of the park, that we have a bodhisattva vow, and we believe that the Dharma, you know, the many different aspects of it, including Sangha and teachings and whatever, we know how powerful it can be. We know how transformative it can be. It's been deeply wonderful for us. So, if we want to save all beings as we chant, then why wouldn't we want to make that accessible to anyone, regardless of, I mean, again, it doesn't matter about what our personal lack of racism or other kinds of biases is, Why wouldn't we find ways to reach out? Why wouldn't we find ways? For instance, we have this model of skillfulness in Mahayana Buddhism, where I might give a teaching and Mark goes, "Oh, that's awesome." And then somebody else is like, "What?" But then I find some other message for you. I find some other practice. Maybe with one person you're strict and another person you laugh, and it's called skillfulness. And like the important part is that the Dharma gets through, not that it's done in some particular way. So that's then to transform to like, if this is the Bodhisattva vow and we are not doing a good job of sharing the Dharma more widely outside of our small cultural, middle class liberal bubble. And somebody even asked at the conference, well, isn't it kind of, like colonialism to think, well, we'll go into, other communities and we'll, save you. But he said, it can be done wrong, but it can be done respectfully, humbly, open-mindedly, whatever. So that's kind of no excuse for not trying. Yes, it can be done poorly, but to open it up. So when he was talking about, he said there's different things you could do. He said there's three different scenarios. One, your sangha, maybe it's small, but for whatever reason it says, we're not really gonna, work on this a lot. He said, let's do nothing, essentially, the do a minimum amount. But he said, what I would recommend, and he was pretty straightforward about this, he said, at least educate yourself so you're not doing harm. So there's more and more of these education for white people, white awake, awakening to whiteness, undoing whiteness, whatever, which I have heard are very, very powerful. We have a resource right nearby. We have Great Vow, and Zen Community of Oregon has come up with a 6-month curriculum. You meet once a month with a small peer group, and you go through this material together. And Chozen was saying, the teacher out there said, she just went through it as a participant. It's not led by anybody. It's just the peers move through this. But I hear it's very, very informative and sobering, and so he said, at least do that, so that because at least we have taken vows not to actually do harm, so at least we can be more conscious of all of this. So that's kind of the pretty bare minimum he recommended. And then, and if you do want to take this on, just think about. And he had this list of things that one priest in there, and I don't know his story, but by the end of Thomas's presentation, he was sobbing quietly. But I think what probably happened, which to some extent happened to me as well, is Thomas was able to show you this way of looking at our sanghas and the assumptions that we make, and really made you question them in a way that wasn't very comfortable. he described like coming through the door of a Zen center, which ours is relatively like bright and friendly. We have the lights on, but it's not atypical to go to a Zen center. All the lights are off. Everybody's already like this, and everybody's already walking by. And now you're supposed to take off your shoes, and you're supposed to go into the Zendo. You're supposed to bow to your seat and bow away from your seat. And then you're supposed to sit there silently facing a wall and not move. And then you get up and you walk in a line, and then you go into, then you have the break for tea, and then everybody's like, oh, hi, so then you see everybody's okay. He's like, why don't you have tea first? Yeah. Why don't you, just a small thing. We're not talking about don't be Zen anymore. Just could you do the tea? Which, I kind of feel like we have a little bit of that. We're not having the tea at the first part, but people kind of just stand around and chat, and we don't have to necessarily keep silence in the Zendo. And so there's a little more of that friendliness with the guest master and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But he also pointed out, and this was a really sobering thing for priests, that He said, and so if you really want to take this on, better pastoral care. So the typical like Zen thing, right, has been just, I'm giving you the practice. You want to do it. You don't want to do it. You can hack it. You can't hack it. That's the essence of it, right? As opposed to, most people of color are going to be coming from different spiritual traditions where Thomas was great at this. He was just like, if my brother died, you know. And you come over and you find out how I'm doing. If I just got a new job, you celebrate with me. Like he's like, this is what most people think of as spiritual communities, is that people pay attention to each other, they notice the details, they reach out to each other, and we're kind of like, and then another aspect he mentioned was this would come about to some extent through the, you know, education process, but just there's cultural differences in the way you express things, and our white culture, we are very emotionally staid. And so to be more inclusive, you eventually need to find ways to be more comfortable with more emotional, more revelation of emotion, more
noise
and wow, you know, like I was just watching Bill Maher last night, and Neil deGrasse Tyson was on there, and he was just like, he was getting all worked up about what he was saying. He was like, and there's Bill Maher next to him kind of going like so, you know, that there's these cultural differences. Also the sensitivity about the reality for, it's just statistical, but the likelihood that a person of color is going to have experienced poverty and lack of opportunity is a lot greater than any white person that walks through this door. And so when we start to talk about stuff like, you know, our college and all of our opportunities and, you know, the relative hardships we've had or the trips that we hope to take, I mean, that's, I think this is something we would explore in those peer group, you know, awakening to whiteness, which is like, we can't pretend, we can't undo the color of our skin. We can't pretend to be who we're not. This isn't about building up shame, but on the other hand, you know, if you just knew somebody in the room had experienced extreme poverty, you would speak differently. You would phrase things differently instead of just kind of assuming everyone had the opportunity to go to college. Or everybody, you know, has a safe place to go home to at night or whatever. So, and I don't know that we're at this place, but these are the kinds of conversations I would like to start to have. Sanghas have also started people of color sanghas, specific, mm-hmm. and depending on how they're done, those are, the people of color say are absolutely amazing. Just so, and I don't know if you've had the opportunity to be the only white person in a sea of brown faces. Now, and that's still different because we're still from the dominant culture, right? So there's still, but you cannot not think about race in that situation. Always, you know, wondering about the difference and are they looking at me differently? It's just front and central all the time. And it's exhausting. So, and the sad thing is that many sanghas have found other people push back against the creation of these things. There are people who will get upset because, and I didn't even go into that much detail about how we end up tweaking Buddhist teachings to excuse the continued racism and prejudice, but one of the classic ones is that, you know, we're trying to dissolve the self, right? let go of all of these distinctions. The self is ultimately empty. So no man, no woman, no me, no you, no, which is to some extent true. But and then if you just wash away all the differences that people have experienced and continue to experience, you're just, first of all, that's wrong. The Buddhist teaching is about, you know, there's the absolute and the relative, and they are both simultaneously true. So even though there is ultimately no fixed self or difference, there is. So we have to, and that the, this is a quote by bell hooks that I'll end with. Beloved community is formed not by the eradication of difference, but by its affirmation, by each of us claiming the identities and cultural legacies that shape who we are and how we live in the world. Any thoughts or questions?
Oh, yeah.
I got thoughts and questions. Portland's very white, but I am in a unique position to have many black friends. And they were all at church this morning playing the bass and singing and playing the drum kit and playing the piano, and there ain't no drum kit in here. And they're not going to come here. You know, why on God's green earth would Randy Monroe and LaRonda Steele and Brian Foxworth come in here and sit down quietly and stare at a wall? They're not going to, the black church is strong, it holds them up, they love it, they look forward to it. It's the community, and I don't think we can draw people from that huge, courageous, inspirational institution that is the black church. But having said that, I guarantee you that there's some nerdy kid in there that his auntie is dragging him to this loud, cacophonous thing every Sunday, and he's not happy. You know, there's somebody there that would rather do something a little more introspective, and you know, and be drawn, and maybe he's reading books at home about Japanese culture or something. Who knows?
Yeah.
We don't know. That there has to be some kind of, here we are, for people like that,
right?
Maybe the big loud cacophonous black church is just not for them. So but I think that, you know, we also run the risk when we get worried about the diversity, inclusion, you know, I remember when I first moved out from West Virginia, and I went to a Saturday market with my mom and her boyfriend at the time, and I literally asked her, where are all the black people? Because I was from Charleston, you know, it was like, you know, where we live is mostly black neighborhood. And so it was really weird to me how white it was. Okay. But, you know, I think we run the risk of saying, when we go, you know, how come there's no black people in here? And then maybe a black person comes in and we go, there's a black person here, yay! That's objectifying that person.
Yeah.
You know, we run the risk of objectifying somebody in that way. And that's the white liberal version of racism. You know what I mean?
Right,
it's not the same. It's definitely not the same as the computer fluid waving time. But, you know, we run the risk of objectifying people. But I think the main reason we don't see black folks here is because there's no drum kit in here. But that's from my personal experience with my friends who were all playing gigs in church this morning.
And so there's this question. It's very humbling. There's this question of, like, you know, how much do you, it's not really in our, you know, like, change everything so that we have outreach and we're not doing what it is that we do best anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, and yet I found, like, really studying the history, like with Anne Gleig's presentation, she really, it was very humbling, she really challenged our whole idea. We're like, well, this is the tradition. And she's like, not really. Like, you kind of made that stuff up. Like, our emphasis on session, on those silent meditation retreats and exactly how we do them, kind of a creation. I mean, they're inspired, but And then we left aside what I think could be an inn for many people. We left aside all the celebrations. When you go to an Asian Buddhist church, they got New Year's, they got singing, they got dancing, they've got parades, they've got dragon costumes, you know, you see the young girls are all, you know, for the parade, they're all dressed up in pretty dresses, and the guys are doing athletic stuff, and, you know, it's more holistic. It includes more of who we are as human beings. And so, you know, somebody might become part of the community like that. And then, what is that about mindfulness? You know, like, we're insisting that people come through this kind of strict, narrow door. And does it have to be so? Yeah.
I sometimes wonder if, you know, because Soto Zen, Rinzai Zen, it's so identified with Japanese culture or even just Asian, and it really, I don't want to say it makes it a little bit inaccessible, but it requires a certain willingness to kind of translate as you go for the American mind. Mm-hmm. And we have to ask what words mean.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's, you know, all the statues are Asian, all the entire environment is Asian, Japanese, mm-hmm. The roads, I mean, everything. We have Japanese names. When we receive Dharma, the word Dharma.
Yeah.
So there's, and maybe, you know, the why there's so many people with college degrees or certain backgrounds is there's a certain willingness mm-hmm. to constantly be finding a way to access something that's yeah. not immediately obvious to anyone walking in the door. And I was trying to think of an example of something that has been adapted from a foreign culture to be more accessible to Americans, and maybe the Catholic Church. I mean, when they stop speaking Latin and they have banjo masses, and whatever, you know. Or, but you know, they still have the robes and they still have a lot of the liturgy. Yeah. But people have found a way to make it accessible for them, and there are plenty of Black Catholic churches and. Hispanic, and I mean of all cultures, and I don't know if it would lose an essential quality of what Zen is all about to make it just American. I was going to say white bread, but that's kind of a white bread, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting because I think I think that translation process is going to take a while. So, interestingly, Roshi Kennett, she cut her ties with Japan, she got rid of all the Japanese terms, she called it serene reflection meditation. They wore robes, but they were more like, you know, Christian monk robes. They give Christian monk, now they do, Christian monk names. Or, you know, European names. So she, you know, that was her aim, get rid of all that crap.
But she put new crap in.
She did. She did. And
Lord.
And the thing is that it's tricky because then if you get this herd of cats and everybody translates it their own way, and then it's like, well, what do we have in common and how can we come together? So it's almost like if you might throw the baby out with the bathwater right. if you try it too soon.
Yeah.
And yet I do, you know, it
and
is this.
And do you lose the essence of what?
And then it is this continuing process. So here's this interesting story. We had a brief opening ceremony at this conference. And I had thought we were going to be in the meditation hall for this ceremony, but we weren't. They just decided to have it in this lecture hall where we had been meeting. And so we had no chant books. And so I wanted everybody to recite the Heart Sutra, but we needed to chant the consensus translation like we do, because, you know, the Soto Shu got Americans together and made them come up with a consensus translation But actually, there's all kinds of translations. Every lineage came up with their own translation. But we didn't have the chant books, so we couldn't chant the Heart Sutra together because everybody has a different translation. So somebody said, let's chant it in Japanese. And everybody could chant it in Japanese because the Japanese have standardized it. So then ironically, for all of these American priests to get together and do something together, we had to go back to the Japanese. So I don't know. The process is it's tricky, but I think it's the kind of thing where just because it's tricky doesn't mean we stop having the conversation. And there has been some creative stuff done out there, and new sculptors who make more less overtly Asian or overtly male statues. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, I just had a couple of quick points. The first one was, the Black church is a real strong pull in that community. I think it's churches. I think there's a lot of variety. Yeah. But I also know there's a lot of church hurt in that community. LGBT folks don't feel welcome in the church. Mm-hmm. Often go, and often lots of folks know they're LGBT, but it's not a welcoming place. So I think there's a lot of variety within the Black church and a lot of hurt within the Black church. There's also Black Buddhists. I mean, I'm reading a book right now by an ordained Zen priest who identifies as African American and lesbian, and I can't think of her name.
Earthlyn Manuel?
Yeah, she wrote a book, it's called The Heart of Tenderness or something like that, which I'm reading right now, where she just lays out her experiences within Zen communities. She's a very committed Zen priest, but she lays out her experience in Zen communities, even down to doing some mindfulness meditations where she was asked to feel her skin, and it was jarring for her because her experience of other people have perceived her based on her skin color has often not been a positive thing. And it was incorporated into the session she was in as if it was just like, you know, just a thing we're going to do now, and then we'll do our meditation, and she just couldn't even do it. Mm-hmm. So I think this is, it's a really interesting thing to think about, but in the work that I've done, the one of the directives is always listen to the people who are already doing this. So reading people who are already part of this experience, I think, is really illuminating. So if you have interest, the book is phenomenally well written, too.
Yeah, it's very new, Way of Tenderness.
Yeah.
And that was another thing, that one of the recommendations was to really, really amplify and honor teachers of color. And actually the Insight Meditation Society is light years ahead of us on this. They're the kind of Vipassana, kind of secular kind of Vipassana people, but they're bigger, a lot richer, and they have focused teacher trainings for teachers of color now, because they were so appalled to realize, like, out of 300 certified Insight Meditation teachers, there were like 5 people of color or something. So they are making a concerted effort on that.
One thing to remember, though, is that a lot of people of color, like we're talking about the Black church, already have, they're already part of very vibrant religious communities. Mm-hmm. So they're not as lost or rejecting off the traditions like white people are. So,
yes.
Like, for example, I'm the only Indian here because all of my Indian friends are at the temple, which is like a Vedanta temple, you know, the whole, so they're there, that's what speaks to them.
Yeah.
And they're not searching. Whereas I think white people have been uprooted so much from, that's why there's so many white people so present. And there's so many white people in the mindfulness thing, which is, they can access the Buddha's teachings through that.
Yeah.
Why do they need to come to Soto Zen? You know what I'm saying?
And that's why we need to avoid getting stuck on getting people of color to come here. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So that's was the big emphasis, was like, the point is that we want to relieve suffering, and we want to make the Dharma accessible and make sure we're not actually making it inaccessible
right.
in ways that we're not
right.
conscious of.
Right.
So that odd black kid might find his way here,
yeah.
more likely, or or also to go out in to go where they are and offer something in a very humble, open way. Maybe there's people at the Black Church that would enjoy some doing mindfulness meditation or some kind of meditative prayer or something like that. So you go out, but also if we're looking to help heal the suffering that racism creates in our culture, you know, it doesn't have to be through offering people the Dharma either. And therefore we could, I've heard this suggestion, we form partnerships with communities, organizations, churches, with people of color that are willing. How can we help? How can we get involved? And I've often thought about, you know, getting somehow striking up some kind of relationship. There's got to be a local Catholic church that's filled to the gills with Hispanic people, many of whom are undocumented and scared. And like, you know, what if we reached out and we said, can we help? And then just by that, I mean, it's not a, they said, when we start doing these things without, you know, aiming to be diverse, we just start working on ourselves and we start being more conscious of the ways we might end up being keeping our door closed to people, and we look out and we get more interested in people, then you end up becoming more diverse, but not through some kind of overt recruitment effort. But Jen, there's just going to be the occasional person that's like, really? What do you guys do? Oh, you guys do meditate? Hmm. Huh. What's that like?
Many of you that have had a chance to talk to me know that I'm actually new here. Like 6 weeks new in Portland. And one thing I do have to say is, I know there is a lot of discussion. I know, you know, the topic of racism and whiteness, it's a really very hot topic, you know, here in Portland. And I'm beginning to kind of recognize the history. Mm-hmm. However, as a someone who has, you know, come across the country from the South most recently, the thing that was an absolutely pleasant surprise, how open and sincere and generous people here are. Mm-hmm. I've had a chance to, in those last few weeks, to try to explore Portland as much as I can, go everywhere I can. the pretty sides, the ugly sides, I wanted to go everywhere. And, you know, and I've had nothing but positive experiences everywhere I've gone. Even when, you know, I speak a little differently and I look a little bit differently and people can tell that I'm not from here, you know, everywhere there's been a very positive response. So I just want to kind of reflect that to the Sangha. You know, to give yourself a pat on the back a little bit, mm-hmm. that, you know, there may be some issues, you know, there's legacies that are actually really, you know, this community has to deal with, but this community is very different in 2018. And that's a beautiful thing. And that's also part of what drew me over here. But, you know, now talking about kind of how to continue, you know, growing this, you know, the concept of inclusivity and all of that combined. So let me share that when I lived in Phoenix, I know there was at some point there was an organization formed called Interfaith something or other Center, and it actually was a good place to, and kind of pull together not only various different, you know, Christian churches, but also Eastern, you know, various Eastern organizations, and by kind of working together, which what you were just saying about, you know, it's that leadership. Once you have the leadership that is willing to kind of talk about and be willing to learn about one another, that leadership is actually going to take it back into their communities, you know, and that's how change kind of happens. I know Austin, most recently I actually moved from Austin, and I'm not sure if there was the same kind of organization, and Austin culturally is almost 180 degree, even for the openness that they think they are, they're 180 degrees from kind of the spirit that I feel here in Portland. But they've had organization, and there's some Buddhist presence there, but Unity Church over there, I know, took kind of a role and kind of building those tentacles with other organization. So I guess that's, I'm sharing that because I want to validate, you know, the idea, the concept. It's, you know, if we can kind of start connecting with other religious organizations, especially that probably each and every one of us here in this room comes from some kind of a religious background that may not be really Buddhist, you know. So, you know, as long as we can kind of start opening the walls, but on the high level, you know, then the most timid members of those organizations start actually kind of recognizing it and saying, there's something to it. You know, change kind of has to happen, but it has to, there has to be enough of the leadership kind of commitment on that. So anyway, I just wanted to share that.
Thank you. Well, I hope that I know Shintai's going to be on the same page as well, and that, I don't know, I hope this can end up being something interesting and fruitful and powerful for our Dharma work, for our practice, as opposed to like, oh God, now we gotta stop talking about that, you know, which some of us, and I look forward actually to, I guess, overcoming my white guilt. I really look forward to examining that and owning it and not having this sense of panic whenever the topic comes up, like, oh God, I'm just, you know, kind of knowing my own ignorance. And just, you know, I'll leave as well on a positive note. It was very interesting. There was a German priest, I mean, he lives in the United States now, but he grew up in Germany. And his observation of all of our discussions, he was kind of like, I see what you're trying to do here, but like, he said, I don't really relate personally because we've done this work. Mm. I mean, I'm sure he wasn't claiming that Germany was perfect, which it obviously isn't, but he said that accountability and that facing into their history and that education, and he said, it just, you know, you could not get away from it. So he said, in a way, it was very interesting to him to look and see to what extent we have not done that about our taking the land from the Native Americans, about slavery, about continuing ridiculous degrees of racism and violence. And we're just kind of like, ah. So maybe the time has come.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
We have one slavery museum.